Kate, only daughter of Bertrand Russell, who is going to talk to us about her father. Kate herself has written an excellent book about him. Kate has lived... Kate has lived most of her life in America. She's done a number of extraordinary jobs, from managing a Harvard literary lunch club to teaching French and German to high school students. But since Bertrand Russell was 51 when she was born and had already lived, as she puts it, a full working life, I'm just going to tell you very briefly about what Russell had already accomplished by the time she became aware of him. Russell was born in 1872, and by the time he was three, both his parents were dead. Together with his older brother Frank, he went to live with his grandfather, Lord John Russell, Prime Minister under Queen Victoria, in a house in Richmond Park. But by now, Lord John was very old, and it fell to his grandmother to bring him up. His childhood was firm, austere, and he said later, lonely. At 17, Russell went up to Trinity College, Cambridge, where he became an apostle and made friends with G.E. Moore, Alfred Whitehead, and the Trevelyan brothers. He left Cambridge uncertain whether to become a politician or a philosopher, and in the meantime married a Quaker, Alice Pearsall Smith. Back at Cambridge, he settled down with Whitehead to produce his major mathematical work, Principia Mathematica. It took them 10 years, and Russell later always said that the mental labour that went into it exhausted him, and that ever after he looked for easier things to work on. During this period, he toyed briefly with politics, standing twice for Parliament on a suffrage ticket, and got drawn into the circle of Fabians with the Webbs at its heart. He also made friends with Wittgenstein and Joseph Conrad. By now, he had met and fallen in love with Ottilie Murrell, and through her was drawn into the fringes of Bloomsbury and friendship with people like Lytton Strachey, Catherine Mansfield, and the Huxleys. Russell was absolutely opposed to the First World War, and when conscription was brought in, joined with the pacifists in an anti-war organisation called the No Conscription Fellowship. It cost him his lectureship at Trinity College, a number of friends, and eventually 4 months in Brixton Jail. But it brought him into contact with Colette O'Neill, with whom he would remain close on and off for much of his life. Soon after his release in 1918, he went to Russia to see for himself what the Russian Revolution actually meant. He'd had great hopes about it, but he came back disillusioned. Finding an invitation to go to China and lecture in Peking for a year, he accepted and took with him Dora Black, a Girton graduate half his age. While in Peking, he almost died of pneumonia, and as he began to recover, they discovered that Dora was pregnant, and they returned to London in time for his divorce from Elise to go through before the baby was born. This baby was John. The following year, Kate was born. I leave it to you to take up the story.
It's always a bit strange to me. There are so many Russell experts, and there's really practically a Russell industry, of which I am only about this much. And I think that the best thing I can do is to talk about the little bit of his life that I knew after he was 51 and up until later when I went to live in America for good and didn't have much to do with him. Well, I was born in December 1923, just after he had lost an election for the second time. Not that he really expected to win it, and I think he would have been perhaps upset if he had. He stood as a Labour candidate in Chelsea. And but on both times that he stood, he did increase the Labour vote, although he didn't win. My first memories are of the house that they lived in Sydney Street. It was 31 Sydney Street. And I can remember that's where they ran their campaigns from, down in the basement, of which I knew nothing at all. My brother John was taken around sometimes to campaign lectures and speeches, but I mercifully was spared that. I've never been a public kind of person at all from the very beginning. But what I remember from Sydney Street is the nice sitting room with a very bright, warm fire and a divan in the corner. It was piled with colorful cushions that they'd brought back from Russia and from China. And there was a dark dining room with a polished table where I used to sit in my high chair with a rather strict white nanny making me eat my egg. Just, you know, like every other middle-class child of the time, except that it was a very warm, happy household, full of laughing and full of love. They left there when I was 3, but I do remember warmth and happiness. After that, we moved to Cornwall, first for the summer. My mother went down and scouted around and found this house that she thought would do for all of us. They had an idea that it would be a good idea for their children to spend half the year in the country where they could learn about agriculture and weather and the tide and things like that. And the other half probably in London, where we could visit museums and learn more academic kinds of things. So that was why they took this house in Cornwall, so that we could expand on that aspect of life. But then they decided that, you know, the time came we had to go to school, and there was no school in the whole country that would please them. So they thought they'd better start their own. And that put paid to the London end of things, because they took over my Uncle Frank's house on the South Downs. He was very reluctant to part with it, but he was broke and he had to. And there they started the school. It was a wonderful place. You know, it was the driveway was a mile long, and it was 3 miles from the nearest village. It was right up there with this tower with a window on all four sides, and you could see everything from up there. It was absolutely fabulous. And he was very sorry to lose it. I think he had actually built the tower himself. My father took that over for his study. We used to have our history lessons up there from my father. And we used to, funny things we used to do. We used to put ginger biscuits on the shovel and melt them in the fire and then eat them. They never minded us doing things like that. But the summer times, those were the best, and the holidays. You know, I still live now in Cornwall, and it still is quite a remote place. And every day that British Rail gets worse, it gets more remote. It took me forever to get here yesterday. But in those days, the trains went just as fast, and there were more of them. And people were always coming. It was made no difference how far away it was. There was my father, and there was my mother, and people came and stayed and visited, all kinds of people. And I can't really tell you much about them, except sort of what their legs looked like, because I was down there at that level. But I can tell you that Tagore wore sandals without any socks. And I can tell you that in the dining room, they were all sitting around this big table, and there was my father at the head of the table. He was carving the meat and cutting the bread and entertaining everybody, laughing at his own jokes with his big loud laugh. And when he cut the bread, he always used to ask, "Would you like bright or wound?" And it was absolutely defeating to me, because whatever you said, you didn't get what you wanted. But he was so I think he was really happy in those days. He was very jolly and he was very affectionate and he was just always fun to have around. He'd tell endless stories. We walked home from the beach, and Porthcurno Beach, the first part of it, you come up this big, steep, sandy slope, and it's hard work when you're small and tired. And he used to tell us that that was the Gobi Desert. And I'll tell you, it was a long time before I knew that the Gobi Desert was not Porthcurno Beach. And then he used to tell us stories all the way home to keep us going about the post office, the flying post office. It had wings made of postage stamps. And it used to go off to the most outlandish places. We learned quite a lot of geography from where the post office went. But he wasn't, you know, although he was very affectionate and all that, but neither of my parents was ever really indulgent. And they expected that you ate what was given to you, when it was given to you, and you went to bed when you were supposed to go to bed, and you never made a fuss about anything, you know. Anything that they thought, I mean, that it was all right to say anything, it was all right to be noisy and dirty and rude, but it wasn't all right to be soft in any way. They were quite tough. But it was my father who taught us when we were traveling in the train that you, my brother and I would get up against the windows at the stations and make idiot faces so that nobody would want to get in the compartment with us because there were these two awful children. That was one of the things he taught us to do. And the other thing was when we were driving... well, among the, you know, really respectable things besides, but the other thing was when we were driving in the car, to stick our heads out of the window when we passed another car and shout to the people in it, "Your grandfather was a monkey." I don't suppose they ever heard what we said, but that was what life was like when I was very small, very small. They started the school when my brother was nearly six and I was nearly four. And, well, life was never really quite the same again. It still makes me rather sad when I think about the school, partly for myself and also for them, because they had such incredible hopes for it when it was all much more difficult than they thought it was going to be. The parents didn't always pay, and everything was expensive, and the children were difficult children who, you know, this was the last resort for them. And the teachers didn't really understand what was expected of them, or else they couldn't do it. We used to make their lives a misery, you know, because they hadn't got any, they had no canes or threats or anything to back them up. It was just the teacher had to do it. And I remember one teacher we had, and we persuaded her that we didn't know how to read. All of us knew how to read. We'd been reading for a long time by then. And she got out all these learning to read cards and let us play with them. She, poor woman, she didn't last very long. But, some of them, though, the ones that did last, they were outstanding. I've never learned so much so fast as I did in those first years at school. We really, I think that was my father who, well, when he first began to, you know, when he was a boy and he started to study Euclid, and he said, "I'd never done anything so delicious in my life." I've lost my microphone.
Give me the other one.
All right, that one will do, will it? And I think he really assumed that all children would love Euclid and love learning just as he had. And one of the great disappointments of the school, I think, to him, was that many of them didn't. And not only that, but if you left them free and you liberated them from their dreadful parents, they didn't all turn into angels. Both my parents thought they would. I mean, that was the orthodoxy in progressive education. You just get them away from those terrible, oppressive parents, and they'll be all right. But they weren't. I mean, some of them were really pretty awful. And we lived in fear of them, some of the ones of us who were not so awful. And for me personally, and I suppose for my brother, the personal upset was that, you know, we didn't have our parents anymore. Because we were just 2 out of 20-odd children, and they had to treat us just like everybody else. And, it was very dreary in a lot of ways. But at the same time, I must say that it was a healthy life, and it was a learning life. And all the teaching was very good. What did I learn? I learned French and German and a little Russian and a lot of science and history and English. And we used to, all of us, little sort of 6-year-olds, were reading the Encyclopedia Britannica to find things out. And it seemed easy. When they started the school, you know, when I looked through my mother's papers after she died, and I found all these papers about the school, it was just astounding. They had a sort of notebook for every child about who his parents were and what they did and what their grandparents did and what diseases they'd had and what siblings they had, and beyond that, what the child did every day. Whether he slept and whether he ate and what his bowel movements were like and whether he had tantrums and whether he went to class or not and what the weather was like and what the meals were. And it was just absolutely staggering to me. I had no idea that in this free school with the 20-odd children where everything seemed to us pretty free, all of this noting and observing and writing down was going on. Very painstaking. It didn't go on forever. I think they sort of ran out of steam, rather, because it just got to be too much. And besides that, they must have invested a fearsome lot of money. We had all kinds of wonderful equipment and special furniture and little tables and chairs, and my father had to keep writing all these popular books and going off to America to lecture to support the school. It was a real drain, I think, the whole time. And after he left, he had no idea that my mother could possibly keep it going, because, you know, he thought, this school only lives off my pot boilers, as he used to call them. But she did. She kept it going until the war began. She was a very tough woman, but I'm not here to talk about her. So they fell apart, actually, you know. It's really still hard for me to know just what happened, because both of them came from whole lots of other affairs, and they didn't ever expect that there was going to be a monogamous marriage or anything like that. And they were not into jealousy. He thought jealousy was terrible. And there are other marriages of the period that survived all that sort of thing. I think what really did it in finally was when my mother had a son by another man. And, well, my father, he didn't go for all this aristocratic business, and he didn't believe in titles, and he thought he could do without it, and my mother didn't go for it either. But you know, I have to say, I know this out of my own bones, that being a Russell, with that going back to the time of Henry VIII, you can't entirely get rid of it. And I think that he really didn't like the idea that this American bastard might someday become Lord Russell. And I think it really got under his skin. Although he wouldn't have noticed, he wouldn't have known that's what he was thinking. I mean, he wouldn't have admitted it to himself. But I think that's perhaps what I would have felt if I had been in his position. But besides that, you know, there were other things involved. They'd both gone in other directions by that time. And partly as a result of having the school, my father had decided that absolute freedom was a bad thing, and my mother had decided that it was a good thing. And so she was going in the Neil direction, and he was rather going in the other direction. And they couldn't have... They'd always disagreed about a whole lot of things anyway, but they just disagreed more and more and more, and they disagreed about politics, because she went on liking Soviet Russia and he went on hating Soviet Russia. So they parted, and I don't really want to talk about that. How old am I now? I'm getting on towards 70, but it still is... About the worst thing that ever happened to me was the way they used to fight over us. And we went away to school after that. And the holidays had to be divided down to the half day between them. And if either one kept us a half day extra, there would be lawyers' letters. And, you know, I just don't... It was terrible. It was just really awful. So I don't want to tell you about that. And in 1938, when my father had a third wife and another child, and was still, and he had my brother, and he had me, and he had my mother to pay alimony to, and I think he was still paying some money to his brothers, one of his brothers' wives. So he had a lot of people dependent on him, and no particular job. So he took a job at the University of Chicago for a year and went off there. And from there he went to the University of California at Los Angeles, where they offered him a job. He never really much liked America. It's funny, because he went there a lot of times and he spent a good amount of time there, but he never seems really to have liked it. But in the summer of 1939, it was his turn to have us for the summer holidays. So my brother and I went over there. And it came to be September, and everybody was trying to get their children out because of the war. So we stayed, we all stayed, sitting there in Los Angeles, the whole lot of us huddled over the shortwave radio, listening for what was going to happen next. And all the people of Los Angeles saying, well, you know, it's a phony war, it's nothing, what are you making such a fuss about? It was an awful time to be away. I think, you know, he would have come back at like a shot if he could have, but he had all these dependents. So we stayed, and life really got grimmer and grimmer as the years went on. And he left UCLA, and he didn't get his job at New York because they said he was lascivious and salacious and various other dreadful things. It's really hard. Nobody, I think, quite understood what it was like. We were in a foreign country, and Britain was at war, and what money he had over here he couldn't get out, and he had absolutely no job at all, and he had two college-age children and one sort of three-year-old, and a governess for the three-year-old, and a wife. And if it hadn't been for Albert Barnes of the Barnes Foundation, who came flying out to visit us in California and offered him a job, Albert Barnes brought his little dog with him. And what I remember about the little dog was that it came from France and it only spoke French. And you had to speak to the dog in French. Anyway, that was, you know, it was an absolute lifesaver. I don't know what we would have done otherwise. So he moved to Pennsylvania, and I went away to college in Massachusetts, and my brother went away to college in Massachusetts. And we didn't go home more than we could help, because home was miserable. By that time, my father was really expert at falling out of love. And he was a wonderful father, and he was a great man, but he was, you know, I just thank God I was not one of the women in his life, because he was awful. And there was my poor stepmother, you know, she couldn't come back to England. She didn't know a lot of people there, and there wasn't much money, and she must have been absolutely miserable, I think. And he didn't love her anymore. And when they were at a university, there were always lots of nice, handsome young men who admired her, and that was all right. But when they were stuck in the countryside in Pennsylvania with petrol rationing, it was dreadful. And it was always hot. The place was surrounded with orchards, and I'd go home for the summer, and she felt that you couldn't let all these pears and apples and things just drop and waste. So there it was. It was 90 degrees and steaming and hotter than 90 degrees, and there we were bottling all these blasted fruits all summer long. I don't know whoever ate them all, but because I was not there except in the summers. But little by little, you know, we all managed to get back over here. My brother first, he got through Harvard and he came back and joined the Navy. And then my father came, and he was followed by Peter and my younger brother, Conrad. And then when I got through, I came back. And by that time, my father was back at Cambridge, and I was living in London, working in the Ministry of Information. I didn't see very much of him then. I used to go down to Cambridge once in a while. So that from now on, from the war on, I've only seen him off and on, and never closely. So I can't tell you so much about the rest of his life. Because I went back to America after a while and became a graduate student and married an American and got stuck there. I didn't see him for about 10 or 11 years because we couldn't afford to come over. We did later. But I must tell you that in the 50s, my husband and I got bitten by religion. It happened to a lot of people in the 50s. And he decided that he would give up his job in the State Department in Washington and study to be a clergyman. And, you know, he had three children and he didn't have any savings to speak of. And I remember when I had to go and see the bishop, and he looked at me and he said, you know, what's all this? And I said, well, we've got three children, and they're 6, 4, and 2, but they're very good children. He said, that's not the point. What are you going to live on? We said, God will provide. And one of the ways that God provided, and I always thought it was pretty funny, was that my father went to the Bank of England. They thought it was pretty funny too. And he said to the Bank of England, look, you've got to let me send some money over. At that time, you still couldn't send money from this out of this country. He said, you've got to let me send some money over to support my son-in-law. He's studying. He's going to be 3 years out of a job. He's studying to be a clergyman. And they thought that was pretty funny, too. So we did. We did that. And we spent 1 year in Plymouth in England. My husband was attached as a curate to the church there. And one of our children was born in Plymouth. And that year we saw something of my father, but not a great deal. He was in Wales and we were in Cornwall, and he had the world to take care of, and I had children to take care of. And I remember once, while we were still in America, and I wrote and said he was very much exercised then about nuclear weapons, and I said, living in America, we're a bit more concerned about civil rights. That was the thing that we were all concerned about then. And he wrote back and he said, well, that's all very well, but if there's a nuclear war, there won't be any civil rights to be concerned about. Of course, he was quite right, but it didn't seem as urgent to us as it did to him. Later on in the 60s, we visited him in Wales a couple of times. But then he would put the whole lot of us to stay in the hotel, and we would go up and have tea with him. And, it was wonderful. Port Marion is an absolutely fantastic place to stay, and it was wonderful, but all we got to see of him was sort of tea time every day. And I sort of felt a bit kept at a distance. But by that time, he was so preoccupied with saving the world that I think it happens when you get very old. My mother got the same way, that a lot of the personal relations don't mean so much anymore. If you're really concerned about something bigger than that, and so many of your friends are already dead anyway, and you kind of cut yourself off from personal relations. And that was the way that it was at the end. And then I was back in America, and he was really madly busy. I remember during the Vietnam War, we opposed it too, but we used to think that he'd really gone overboard. I mean, the things that he said and the things that he did and his war crimes tribunal, and I thought it was, I used to be embarrassed, I used to pretend I wasn't who I was, but actually it's come out since. I mean, nearly everything he said was true. All those horrors that went on, they did go on, and it's just that we, being Americans, didn't like to think that our country was doing that sort of thing, but it was. And he was right. He may have been a little shrill and a little vituperative, but basically what he said was true, which I had to acknowledge, but not till after he was dead. And I used to think in those days, well, he's very old, and I probably won't see him again, and anyway, he's very deaf, and he's totally preoccupied with the world, and it won't, when he dies, that won't be so really, as far as I'm concerned, in a lot of ways, he's dead already. But just the same, it was awful. It was really, thinking about how I could never talk to him, I would never hear his jokes again, and I'd never be able to tell him this or that or the other, and he won't see his two youngest grandchildren. But, that's the way it was. He was just, I don't know what I can say, except that he was a great man and he was a marvelous father, but he was also a very terrible man to a lot of people. And I think I'll stop at that point.